Hope everyone's doing well this morning. All right, Ephesians 6. We're going to be continuing our series in Ephesians. So you may want to turn to chapter 6. Before we get started, I want to say a word of prayer, though. Father, thank you for the day. Thank you for an opportunity to study a passage like this one. You know, it's not glorious. It's not something that will blow our minds. I don't think it's something that's something that's hard to even really understand once we've read your passage, God. But on the other hand, it is something that's practical, incredibly practical in our lives. So, you know, as we're talking about being parents and being employees, I pray that you speak to us today. Amen. All right, Ephesians 6, 1 through 9. Looking at a couple of topics here, like I said, they're not something that... That'll blow your mind. These aren't theological, huge topics here. On the other hand, they are very practical. These are things that we all do every day. You know, either we are a child or we are a parent, and most of us have jobs and we're working or we have worked or we hope to be working soon. You know, so these are really practical things. So, you know, it's good to talk about this stuff. Before I get into the passage that we're looking at, though, I want to look back just a bit, because we've been doing this series in Ephesians for a few weeks now. A couple of weeks ago, we came across this verse in Ephesians 5. He says, don't get drunk with wine, for that's dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit. So I want to talk about that, because that has a direct bearing on what we're going to be talking about today. That verse is a command. You know, he says we're supposed to be filled with the Spirit. Now, that's not something that we normally think of that, oh, okay, I'll just go do that. You know, it's something that's a little more ambiguous than that. But it's really important to our walk as Christians, because he says it allows us to be subject to one another, first of all. And what that means is that once you're filled with the Spirit, once you're firm in your relationship with God and he's filling your heart, that allows you to be able to serve other people and put their needs in front of yours. And because you don't have to worry about stepping down for somebody else and what that'll look like for you, because you're firm in your relationship with the King of the universe. You know God accepts you, and so it allows you to put your needs on the side to help somebody else. You know God's going to take care of you. It also, he talks about making a melody with your heart to the Lord. And that is... You know, it's something that's a little weird, but it gives you that peace, that harmonious chord in your heart, that song to God in your heart. When he's filling your spirit, when you're filled with his Spirit, your heart sings to him. It's a weird thing to say, and we talked about it more in depth a couple of weeks ago, but it fills you with his peace, and it fills you with his power and with his confidence. And it also allows you to do this, which is the speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. And, you know, that means that song in your heart that you're singing to the Lord is able to spill out in your relationships with others. You're able to talk with other people about what God's doing in your life and the things that he's teaching you, the things that he's working on, and you're able to listen to them and listen to what God's teaching them, and we're able to encourage one another. So being filled with the Spirit is something that should touch every aspect of our lives. And then he goes on to talk about how it should look at in our marriages. We talked about that last week with Dave, you know, how being filled with the Spirit and being a Christian, how that looks in the marriage. And today we're going to look at it in a couple of other relationships with being parents and being at work. But, you know, if you don't have the Spirit in you, if you don't have Christ's Spirit within you, then this stuff is really just good advice. It's not something that transforms your life. It's something that you can hear, and you could say, yeah, that sounds good. Or you could say, yeah, forget that. It's not something that will transform you. So the first step in being filled with the Spirit is beginning that relationship with God. And if you're here and you don't have that relationship with God, you know, this is the part you need to focus on right here early. You can zone out the rest of the day. This is important. If you want a relationship, the Bible teaches us that there's a gap. There's this chasm between us and God, and it's because he is holy. He's righteous. And, you know, he can't overlook the sin in our lives, the way we've rebelled against him, the way we treat one another, the evil that's within our hearts. He can't overlook that stuff because he is holy. And yet, he loves us enough that he can pushed the punishment on that. He took it upon himself in the form of Christ. When Christ died on the cross, he wasn't dying for his own sins. He was dying for yours and for mine. So to have that relationship with God, to begin to be filled with his Spirit, it means we just have to come to God and say, look, you know, I can't work my way to you, God. I can't work my way. I can't do enough good deeds to get into heaven. I can't do enough to earn your forgiveness. So I want to accept it as a gift. I want Christ's death to pay for my sins. Once you've done that, you begin that relationship with God, you begin to be filled with the Spirit, and instead of good advice in the Bible, it starts to transform your life. It starts to transform you into the person that God's designed you to be. And that's what we're looking at today, in our relationships with our kids and with our parents and with our coworkers. All right, so starting in verse 1 of chapter 6, he says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for that is right. That's enough for me, you know. That's the verse I like to put on a sticky note and just right on their foreheads, right on the kids' foreheads. Don't forget this one. You can memorize, forget the rest of the Bible. Obey your parents, he says. Unfortunately for the rest of us, he goes on. He says, honor your father and your mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may be well with you, and that you may live long on the earth. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and the instruction of the Lord. Okay, so we're talking about parents, and we're talking about children. And specifically in this first verse, the word he's using for children is specifically little children. Now, we're all children to one degree or another, right? We all have parents. However, this first verse is talking about little children. He says, obey your parents. Now, why is that? Why does he say obey your parents? Is it because your parents are always right? Is it because your parents always have your best interests at heart? We'd like to say that's true, but we know it's not. Is it because, they're, you know, your blood or whatever? No, the reason is, it's right there in the passage. It's right there in that same verse. Why does it say we should obey our parents? Because it's right. That's the right thing to do. Our universe was created by a moral being, and he's created with a moral fabric, and there are certain things that are right. There are certain things that are just the way that they go. And as little children, to obey your parents, it's just right to do so. Whether your parents are right or wrong, we're called to obey them. You know, most parents have the best interests of the kids at heart. But he goes on and he quotes this this commandment, one of the Ten Commandments. We're going to look at two of the ten today, actually. But the first one we're going to talk about is this one, where he says, honor your father and your mother. Now, that one is written to all of us. That one's written to adults and to children, because we all have parents. He says we should honor our father and our mother. So what he's saying is, look, little children, if you want to obey this commandment, the first thing you got to learn is to obey your parents. Not sin, you got to obey your parents. That's what it looks like for little kids to honor their father and their mother. So as parents here, there are no little kids here. So as parents, how do we help our kids to do this? You know, this is key for us, I think, because normally this is something for me, as I'm screaming at my kids, you know, I'm telling them, you know, obey your parents, right? So as a parent, though, I should be really looking at how can I help my kids to do this? Shouldn't I? 1 Corinthians 8 talks about how we shouldn't stumble our brothers. And what that means is, you know, we have freedom and we can do things, and sometimes what we do will cause somebody else to sin. It'll cause other people to have problems with their conscience, and it'll cause them to fall into sin. That goes doubly for our kids because we're around them so much. They look to us. And, if we're having problems with our kids disobeying, we're having problems with our kids spouting off with the mouth or whatever, we got to look at how can I help them to do this? How can I help my kids to honor their parents? Because I should be helping them to follow these commands. So we have to be the kind of parents that are honorable, right? We have to be the kind of parents that make it easier for the kids to follow us, make it easier for our kids to listen to us. That's the kind of parents we should be. And one of the first things they do is they look at how we treat our parents, and they look at how we treat others around us, and they look certainly at how we treat them. You know, there's an old fable, one of the Grimm fables. You know, those are, if you've ever read the actual text, they're horrible, but they always have a bad ending. You know, people die, and you watch the Disney version, and it's all happy. But there's one about this family. You got this father and a mother and their little kid, and then they have his dad living with them. And the dad is, he's losing his mind, he's old, and he's real sloppy at the dinner table. He's making a mess of things. So, you know, the wife, she gets real mad at him, and she starts, you know, treating him bad. She starts putting bibs and stuff around him, and eventually it gets so bad that the guy, she's like, that's it. You want to eat like a pig? We'll treat you like a pig. And she goes out to the farm. You know, they live on a farm. She goes out there. She brings out a trough, and she feeds him out of the trough, right, every day when she feeds him. And one day she sees her son, and he's carving something out of wood. And she says, hey, what are you doing? He says, oh, I'm carving the trough that I'm going to use to feed you with when you get older. You know, yeah. So all of a sudden, of course, she turns, this is one of the better endings, she turns over and she starts treating him with respect. You know, our kids see how we treat each other. Our kids see that. They mimic that. So we have to be the kind of people, the kind of parents, then, that the kids want to follow. The kids want to obey. The kid, the kind of, that they, it's easy for them to honor. So what is honor? You know, what does it mean when it says to honor your father and your mother? There's several things that it's not that I think we get confused with. First of all, it's not affection. The commandment is not, does not say have affection for your father and your mother. You know, a lot of parents don't deserve affection. A lot of parents are unlovable. A lot of parents have done awful things to their kids. So, you know, to put out a blanket statement that you should always have affection for your parents, that's not accurate. It's not possible, and it's not even in accordance with God's will, I don't think. It's not something that he would say to do, that have affection for people who are evil. It doesn't say we should trust them. You know, some parents are untrustworthy. Some parents, you know, they just don't have, they're not trustworthy. They let you down. They turn you over out into the, you know, the wilderness without any instruction at all. You know, they're not good parents. They don't deserve trust. And it doesn't even mean obedience, even though Paul says for little children to obey their parents. Adults, you know, our relationship with our parents changes, right? You shouldn't always obey your parents. You know, some folks will say, well, I can't honor my father or my mother because, you know, I would mean I have to obey them, and they're terrible people. They don't, you know, they want to control me, whatever. That's not what we're talking about. You're fine, because we're not talking about you always have to obey your parents. And that's why I make that distinction between little children and adults, because adults, we don't always obey our parents. In fact, to have a relationship where you are always turning to your parents and always doing what they're telling you to do as an adult, that's bad news. That's not healthy. So what is honor? What does that mean? Well, that word that's translated as honor, in that Hebrew word in the Old Testament, it also means weight. It means gravitas might be the word that we hear a lot in the news, but it means weight. You know, it doesn't mean we should make fat jokes about our parents. What it means is we should consider what they say. We should treat them with the gravity of who they are, of what they've done. You know, they may not have been parents. They may have vacated their right to affection. They may have vacated their right to any kind of obedience or love from you, but you should always honor them because of who they are. It's kind of like the president. You may not like the guy who's in the role of the president, but you have to respect the office. He's still our president. This is the same thing. If we're going to honor our parents, we have to honor these are our parents. Right or wrong, the things that they've done for us, you know, may have been poor or they may have been great. You may have had the best parents in the world. You may have had absent parents, but you're still called to honor them. So what does that look like? You know, that may mean calling them occasionally. It means that, you know, debating with your parents on what the right thing to do is all the time. Arguing with your parents, that's not the right thing to do. But maybe just, you know, taking what they say with, okay, I appreciate your input there. And I'm going to move forward with that, what I'm going to do, but I really appreciate your input. You know, it may mean just telling them something. That you know, all our parents want to see their kids learn something from them. You know, so telling your parents, you know, that, you know, the one, you know, one thing that you taught me that I'll always take with me is, you know, how I should balance a checkbook, or how I should fix the sink, or, you know, something that, you know, tell them that kind of stuff. That's important. And so he goes on and he says, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in discipline and instruction of the Lord. And I want to focus on that word but there. I underlined it on purpose because it's not This word in the Greek, it's an either or thing. It's either you're going to bring up your children, provoke them to anger, or you're going to raise them up in discipline and instruction of the Lord. It's not one of those things that's optional. He says if you don't bring them up in discipline and instruction of the Lord, they're going to be provoked to anger, is what he's saying here. So it's a contrast. It's one or the other here. And so I want to talk about what that means. What does it mean to provoke your children to anger? You know, I'm one of those dads that likes to pick on his kids a little bit. And if you know my daughter, you know that she doesn't have a short fuse. She's got a switch. She's either happy or she's furious. You know, it's one of those things. So, and sometimes I tweak her and I make her mad, which is wrong. I'm not saying that's right, but that's not really what he's talking about here. What this term for anger, it's more of a general lifestyle of angst, of antagonism with the world. I mean, all teenagers have angst. If you've ever seen a Twilight movie, you know that. I mean, there's angst there, right? But as they grow older, I mean, are you setting your kids up to be at odds with the world? Are you setting your kids up to have a constant life of frustration and struggle? Or are you setting them up with instruction and discipline in the Lord? And that's what we're talking about. When he says, don't provoke your kids to anger, he says, you know, do them a favor. Give them discipline and instruction. Otherwise, they are going to be at odds with the world as they grow. You're setting them up for failure if you don't do this. So what is discipline? You know, is discipline just beating your kids and screaming at them? I hope not. No, it is something that we have to do, though. We have to teach our kids there are consequences. We have to teach our kids that when they make wrong decisions, that bad things happen. But it goes beyond just that kind of discipline. We're talking about teaching them to be a disciplined person, teaching them to be somebody who can look at a situation and think about, you know, what is the proper thing to do here before they impulsively do the wrong thing. Teaching them to consider the lives of others around them before they make decisions and act. That's what we're talking about, discipline. Having a life of discipline. Being a disciplined person, being able to have self-control. And he says we should give them instruction. We need to teach them right from wrong. We need to teach them, we need to teach them about God. He says instruction in the Lord. We need to teach them about our faith. It's important. So you think about life without these. If we did not give our kids discipline and instruction, I mean, think about a kid who has none of that. And they grow in to be older. They're kind of like drifters. You know, I've known people like this where their parents just were kind of hands off and they didn't teach them anything and they didn't give them any kind of discipline. These are kids that have no self-control. They're drifting through life from one sense to the next, from one relationship to the next, from one experience, you know, to the next. And they don't have any kind of firm foundation in their lives. And then you think about what happens if you only give them one without the other. You know, some families, you know, where your father usually is the one, but it's a disciplinarian. You got a heavy discipline household. You know, are you from one of those houses where you had a ton of discipline, but you had no instruction, you had no love, you had no one showing you, you know, coming alongside you and encouraging you? You know, that's terrible. That's a terrible way to grow up. And it ends up damaging the way you treat your loved ones. It ends up damaging the way you treat your own kids because you grow up doing the same thing and now you don't have a relationship anymore. You've got, you're like a warden rather than a father or a mother. But then again, I'm not done yet. Think about the other one, right? When you're teaching instruction, but you're not given any discipline. Now that's kind of the way our culture's going. You know, parents are saying, well, I don't want to teach my kids about my faith because I want them to grow up to make their own decisions. And, you know, they should be able to decide for themselves what's right and wrong. And, you know, on the surface, it seems like maybe that's the right idea. But it turns out that's terrible. That is awful to do to your kids. You know, studies have shown that kids, even when their parents are teaching them the wrong things, even when their parents are teaching them the wrong faith or the wrong, you know, right from wrong, they're teaching the wrong values, at least the parents are teaching them something. And what happens is, as they get older, they're able to then make a decision that, okay, I can critically see that this is wrong, and I can choose to turn away from that. Even if it's the wrong thing. It's the kids whose parents taught them nothing. Kids whose parents taught them no right or wrong, who gave them nothing and let them go and figure it out on their own. These are the kids that have higher suicide rates. They're the kids that have, they're unable to be moral, to make the right moral decisions, not because they don't know right or wrong. They have no foundation. They can't make these decisions because they have nothing. At least, you know, with a parent with conviction will teach them something. Your parent had enough love in their heart to teach you something, even if it's the wrong thing. But without it, they're cut adrift, and they can't cope with moral decisions in their lives. So our job then as a parent is to teach. We're called to be teachers here to our children. We're not called to be their friends. You know, I want to be my kid's best friend. And if my kid's an adult and I'm his best friend, I feel bad for the kid because he really needs friends his own age, right? I mean, there's nothing wrong with having a good, solid relationship with your kids, but your goal should not be to be their friends. You know, we don't discipline our friends, right? We are called to call them out sometimes and help them and to help them to grow, but it's a way different relationship with a parent. You know, that's our goal. Our goal should be to teach our kids. And then I want to talk about this for a moment. He says, fathers, he brings fathers up. He says, don't provoke your children's anger, but bring them up in discipline and instruction of the Lord. Why is he singling out dads? You know, up until the Industrial Revolution, parents, fathers and mothers and kids worked together, right? If you had a farm, the more kids you had, the better, because not only were you more profitable, because you know you had more workers and you had more hands, you were assured that you could hand your business or your farm down to somebody else. But you know, as you got older, you had somebody to take care of you, because that was retirement, right? Your kids would take care of you. Your whole extended family lived there together. And if you wanted to have, unfortunately, if you wanted to have two or three kids to take care of you as you got older, you had to have like six or eight kids because they didn't all survive. So big families with lots of kids were important then. And so fathers and mothers would work together for the financial benefit of the family. And, you know, so they would take care of each other. And now we're moving into the Industrial Revolution where the father now leaves the home to make money and the mother stays at home. And we get this thing in our head that it's right for the mother to stay home and she's the one that raises the kids. Or what's even worse is if you're a mother and you've got this in your head and you think that this is your job to raise your kids and you got to work. Now you're trying to be two people, you're trying to be superwoman, you can't do it all. Fathers have to be involved in this. We saw last week God's role for the man in the household, like it or not, is to be the spiritual leader in the house. The fathers, it's our role then to be raising our kids in discipline and instruction in the Lord. It's our role. You know, it's not just a command that God gives us to be the spiritual leaders, man. It is, unfortunately, the way we're designed. So, we've talked about this before, where if you're the father, you're the husband, you are the spiritual leader of that house, whether or not you're leading. So if you are leading your house and you're spiritually strong, your house will move that direction. But if you are leading your house and you're spiritually weak and you're going down the toilet spiritually, that's where your house is going to go, unfortunately. Because that's what we're looked at. That's what our role is. That's just the way we're designed. So, you know, if you've got a wife that's trying to grow spiritually and trying to move spiritually and trying to be in that relationship with God, and you're dragging her down that toilet, then that's a really uphill battle for her, isn't it? You know, we're spiritual leaders in our house. It's our goal, it's our role to raise our kids as, you know, with the discipline and instruction of the Lord. It's just the way we're called to do it. So putting that off and letting, you know, she'll handle it, you know, that's the kind of thing that... you know, unfortunately, you know, I'm bad at this. You know, the kids come home, they've had a long day at work, I've had a long day at work. You know, go do your thing and relax, I'll do my thing and relax. And unfortunately, sometimes that means the rest of the evening goes that way. Hopefully, you know, I'm trying to fight against that because I realize that I cannot raise my kids in discipline and instruction if I don't ever have a relationship with them. If I'm not involved in their lives. Okay. So he goes on. Paul does, and he talks now about another area of relationships, which is work relationships. He says, slaves, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling and sincerity of your heart as to Christ. not by way of eye service as man pleasers, but as slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart. With good will, render service as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good thing each one does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether slave or free. And masters, do the same things to them, and give up threatening, and knowing that both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no partiality with him. All right. So we're talking about employees and employers. First of all, the reason I said employees and employers, not slaves and masters, is because this passage is not about slavery. This passage does not condone slavery. You know, a lot of people are critical about this passage. They say, see the Bible, it's regressive, it promotes slavery. That's not the case at all. The fact of the matter is that one-third to one-half of the Roman Empire, the population was slaves. But it's not the kind of slavery that you and I think of. It's not, you know, when we think of slavery in America, we think of the horrible things that we did, as, you know, that they did, I should say, that where they captured people and they made them property, and they forced them into indentured servitude. And that's not what was going on. They were, if you were poor, if you were having trouble making ends meet, you would sell yourself into slavery. And you always had, you know, slave labor made comparable money as free labor did. And so you had the ability then to buy yourself out of slavery. So, you know, this passage isn't talking about is condoning slavery. People have, in the past, I mean, when they were defending slavery, they would point to this passage wrongly and say, look, it does, it promotes slavery, which it does. And in fact, the Bible, it was because of Christians that slavery was abolished. You know, it was this guy named William Wilberforce in England that got the ball moving for them to free the slaves in England. And that, again, that launched it here. So we would end slavery here as well. And, you know, this is a guy that was born in a lap of luxury. He was rich. He had a silver spoon in his mouth. But he studied the Bible, and he had a real heart for the Lord. And he met this guy who was his friend who wrote Amazing Grace, because he was a slave trader. And they started to realize that the Bible says that we're all equal in God's eyes, that we're all born as we're built in the image of God. So now, how does that jive? How can people be owned by other people? It's not right. So he started fighting slavery, and it was a lifelong battle for him, but he did it. And so it's not that the Bible condones slavery at all. It's the Bible teaches us better. You know, as historians, when you look, as people, we look back and we think, how can they let slavery go on for so long? You know, from our perspective on the other side of it, we look back, and how could you let that go on? Historically, though, what you should be thinking is, how on earth did it change? You know, since the beginning of man, the weak have been enslaved by the strong. What on earth made somebody think that it was wrong and finally change that? And it was God right here. It was his word. So we're not condoning slavery, and we're really talking about employees and employers. These are people who worked. So, you know, we talk about Christianity. We talk a lot about how it is to follow God, and usually that's just for the part of the day that you're not at work, right? This is how you follow God at work. This is how we should be Christians at work. That's what we're talking about here. You know, we are designed for work. As people, as human beings, we're designed to be workers. You know, you think about Adam. What's the oldest profession? It's not what you think. It's gardening. Gardening is the oldest profession. That was the first, what? Right. I mean, he created Adam and Eve, put him in the garden, told Adam, here's your job. Tend the garden. Name all the animals. That's what you got to do. So this is creative work that he had to do. He had to think up names for all these. He had to find them, categorize them. He had to take care of the garden. Gardening, he didn't say pave over the whole thing and make it whatever you want. He didn't say just let it grow and it'll be fine. He said, no, you got to tend the garden. You got to work with your hands. It's what we're designed for. Working is one of the Ten Commandments. I mentioned we're going to look at two of the Ten Commandments today. Working is one of the ten. And I realized that just recently, and I thought, really? Is that one of the Ten Commandments? And of course it is. It says, you know, 6 days a week you're supposed to work. On the seventh day is the Sabbath, you're supposed to rest, right? And I always think, well, that's the Sabbath law. We're supposed to take a day off for the Sabbath. That's what the Jews were supposed to do. And I never really considered the other half of that, which just says you're supposed to work 6 days out of the week, right? We're supposed to work. That's what we're designed for. There's a reason for that. God wants us to work. And we're built to be creative. We're built, we're put together in such a way that we're supposed to create. Now, I don't know, I can't speak for you guys. I know that I don't always feel that way at work. I don't feel like I'm being creative. I don't feel like that I'm being fulfilled and that this is what I'm designed for. And I hope I'm not the only one. I don't think I am. See, in our society, we have two common approaches to work. You know, we've got the first one where we look to work for significance. You know, this is our drive. We go to work. What do you do? When you meet somebody new, what do you do? Oh, well, I'm a programmer, or I'm a farmer, or I'm a construction worker. Right? We define ourselves by what we do. And we look to work for significance. We look to our jobs for fulfillment. And I used to be like this. You know, I used to struggle with my job because I was a pencil pusher. You know, I didn't feel like I was working in this office, an insurance company. I'm not doing anything. And not doing anything of significance. And I looked to my wife and her job, and she's like putting people away. She's protecting the community. She's a probation officer. You know, she arrests people. You know, that's important stuff. Here I am. I'm just shuffling paper, and I don't even have paper anymore. It's all digital. So, you know, I remember a time when I was angry with God, and I was crying out to him in my car saying, God, you know, why can't I have a job where I have fulfillment, something that's fulfilling, something that's important? And it was almost as if he was speaking right next to me. He said, why are you looking to your job for significance? You know, why would you look to a job for significance? Yes, we're built to do work, but that's not where we're supposed to draw our significance from. And so, you know, that was a real eye-opener for me. And I was ready to walk out of Aetna at the time. This was, over 10 years ago, probably more. I'm still there. I'm still at Aetna. I still work there. And, but gradually, you know, he set me on the right track, and then gradually over the years, I started going towards the other extreme, which is we look at work as something that stinks. It's like a curse. It's something that we have to do, but it pays the bills and allows us to do something else, which is more important, right? And that's for a long time, and even longer than the other way, I was looking at work this way, which is equally wrong. You know, work is a terrible thing that we have to endure in order to have money to pay the bills so we can do the things that are important or the things that are more fun. You know, this is countercultural to what we're teaching here. This is what the Roman, the Greco-Roman culture was teaching at Jesus' time and Paul's time, was that work is a curse and that leisure was important. And if you had to work, God forbid, you don't work with your hands. You only, you know, you don't do anything where you're getting your hands dirty. You do something that's cleaner. That was the higher calling, they said. So this is countercultural because this is wrong too, right? I mean, if we're designed to work, we're designed to be... To gain a sense of satisfaction from the things that we do, then this is also wrong. And this is something that I've been struggling personally with a lot because, you know, again, I'm a programmer. You know, I don't do anything that helps people. I don't do anything that is life-changing for folks. So we're going to talk about what we do here. How should we look at work then? Well, God's got a different approach to work. This is the third approach. This is the one that he wants us to have. Keep in mind, we're built to be part of society, and we've been talking about the unity in the body and how we were supposed to be lights to the world and how we work with other people. And imagine if we were not, though. Think for a minute. Let's say if I wanted to build like a desk or something. I want to build a wooden desk, but I don't want to do it without reliance on anybody else, right? So if I'm going to build a wooden desk, what's the first thing I need? Well, I need to get some wood. So what I got to do, I get in the car or the truck and drive out to the woods. Well, wait a minute. I'm not relying on anybody. I'm going to have to invent the truck first, right? I'm going to have to refine some oil and get some gasoline. Maybe I should live next to the woods so I can walk. So I'm going to walk to the woods. And I'm going to push the tree down. I'm going to bite it down with my teeth. No, I need tools. Well, you can't, you know, you're not relying on anybody, so hopefully you can find a branch to use as an axe handle, and then you're going to have to mine some ore out of the ground so you can find that down into some tools so you can cut down the tree. And you start to think about how can we live and do things on our own without anybody else in our society. It's impossible. It would be a lifelong project just to build a desk or a chair. I mean, you couldn't do it. We have to rely on the work of others. That's the way we're designed. That's the way society works, and we are a part of that society. But we're working for God here. You know, God has put us in this position. God has designed us to be this way. So when we're working for God, we're not working like he's looking over our shoulder. I used to think of this passage, and I would think, all right, I'm supposed to work like God is looking over my shoulder, right, with his whip. And, you know, like I'd work if my boss was standing there. You know, oh, here comes the boss. You know, act like you're working. You know, look busy. And that's not how at all. He said, not as like eye service. That's not how God wants you to work for him. He wants you to work for him as if you're working out of love. You know, I look at this passage here, and it says in Romans 12, 1 and 2, which is a great passage. It says, therefore I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind so that you can prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. All right, so here we are. We've got God. We're supposed to be working for him. And what we're saying here is that our lives, even the work we do, is a sacrifice for him. It's something we should do out of gratitude for the things that he's done for us, because he's filled that gap that we talked about earlier. So we have a relationship with him. We should be able to have a work in such a way that it's a sacrifice, it's an offering for him. This is the thing that I do for you, God. And because we're part of society, I think the key to doing this is changing the way we think. That's what verse 2 here is about. Changing the way you think about your job. So instead of thinking of my job as, you know, just something I do until I get to the end of the day, so they give me money, this is something that I can do to help with society, to help people. Now, it's hard. I work at home. I don't interact with a lot of people through work, at least except maybe on the phone or via email more often. So it's hard for me to keep this in mind, and I lost track of this for a long time. But God's teaching me that, look, yeah, you're not locking criminals up. You're not producing something that everybody needs. You're not building houses for the needy. You're not, you know, this is not what you're doing. But what you are doing is writing programs that help people to pay medical bills for folks. That is important. You know, this is important work. You know, if you don't get your medical bills paid, you're going to stop going to the doctor. You're going to stop going to the hospital when you need it. This is important for us to do, and it helps us to do it more efficiently, more accurately. I need to keep doing it. And we need to, so I'm starting to change the way I think about my job. It's no more something that I just, you know, I'm just shuffling programs around, you know, writing code. This is something that I'm doing to help people. And I got to keep that in mind. And I think that's what we all need to do. We need to think about our jobs and how do our jobs help those around us? How do our jobs help our society? You know, that will help us to get past that whole thing where we're, you know, just working for the weekend. And it also helps us to get past that whole thing where we're working for significance, because then, you know, our job is just something we do for us. It's for me, you know, and it's not for others. And neither one of those approaches is wrong. It's something we're supposed to be doing for God, because it's the way he's designed us. You know, I think about one of our favorite shows is our family is Dirty Jobs. Have you ever seen Dirty Jobs? Anybody has seen some people nodding? This guy, he goes and does the most disgusting, horrific jobs with people, you know, cleaning out sewers and climbing under houses to work on plumbing and clean out dead animals and stuff. I mean, he does some of the dirtiest, nastiest jobs. And the jobs that I love the most when I'm watching the show are the ones where I'm watching these people and they love their work. And I mean, you see these guys, and this dude's an exterminator, and he deals with dead animals and all the time. And he loves his job. Or, you know, you see these guys who are working in the sewers or working in these cramped, hot, nasty conditions, and they love the work that they do. Is it because the work that they do is so satisfying? Probably not. These are people that understand that this stuff needs to happen for the rest of us to live. This is stuff that needs to happen for the rest of us to live our lives in our society. These are jobs that are necessary, and that's, you know, that's because, and then, so their mind, it's their mind, where their mind is. How is it that they think about their jobs, and they consider what they're doing, and how it applies to other people, and how it serves other people, and makes their work more fulfilling? That's how I needed to change my attitude, and God's been working on me on that. Okay. But he also talks about employers briefly, and I want to talk about employers briefly, because some of us employ others. Some of us, you know, have employees, and he says, now remember, masters, those of you who are employing others, don't treat your slaves poorly, because your boss is the same as theirs. Your boss is God also. You know, we need leadership in our work, but we need to be steeped in grace. You know, this is how God leads, right? He leads through forgiveness. He leads through coaching and helping us and being patient with us. Now, does this mean that you can't fire your workers who don't do their jobs? No, that's not what this means. But what it does mean is it's pointless to start screaming and yelling and be angry with your employees. You know, I've had bosses that would get angry. I've seen bosses that have just... We had this guy that used to work at Aetna. I don't know if he still does or not. He used to, I mean, daily he was up in the management chain, so he liked to yell at the people who were lower in the management chain. And in their units, he would scream at them at the top of his lungs. How is that helping anybody? Doesn't help anybody. You know, take the whip out of your hands. Follow, you know, this is how we should lead. We should be graceful with our folks. We should be patient. We should be loving. And if we have to discipline, we have to discipline. But, you know, it's not out of anger. It's not out of spite. It's out of, you know, a need to help them and to help the company. And also remember that, you know, God gives us pretty good rewards. And that's what we're called to do too, I think. You know, pay your people fairly. You know, if you're, you know, you don't, a lot of companies these days, I think they're taking advantage of the company. When you have, of the economy, when you have an economy the way it is now, you know, for a long time we had an employee economy where, you know, we're the employees, you need us. And so we can make demands. And now we're in an economy that's an employer economy. And if you don't want this job, take a hike. I got 10 other people that need it. That need it. Not that want it, that need it. I don't have to pay you anything. I can treat you like dirt and you're not going to leave because you don't have any place to go. Don't do that. Don't take advantage of people like that. That's not how God takes care of you, is it? No, God rewards you. He takes care of you. You know, pay your employees. That's what we're talking about. So you're thinking, all that's great news, that's all good advice, but man, you don't work where I work. You don't have my job, right? Some of you may be thinking this. And you're right. I don't have your job. And I don't work where you work. I don't have to deal with your boss or your employees. So what happens if you really want to move, you really want to change jobs, you're really looking to, that your place isn't, your work isn't where you need to be? Well, three things. First of all, check your motives. You know, are you wanting to move? Or are you hating your job because you're not getting the significance that you think you should be getting from it? Or do you hate your job because you're not getting the pay you think you deserve or whatever? Now, are you working for God? You know, that's the first thing we need to check. Check your motives. Are you working for God here or are you working for yourself? The second thing I would encourage you to do is think about, you know, understand that what you're doing is a calling. God has put you in this position for a reason. He's given you skills. He's given you abilities. He's given you a temperament. And there are, you know, I don't mean that there's one specific job for each person, but what I do mean is that God has given you these things. And there are an array of jobs that you will fit into. And then there are jobs that you won't. There are jobs that I can't do, that I'm not built for it. I don't have that temperament. You know, you're in a calling. If you have the skills and the ability to flourish in this job and to do it well, maybe there's a reason that you're doing it. And if you're the fact that you're dissatisfied with it, the fact that you're struggling with your job, maybe it's because you're approaching it wrong. You're approaching it for you instead of for God. Finally, though, maybe, you know, maybe it's time to look for a new job. Maybe you build defective baby bottles or something on purpose. You know, maybe you work for a software company that has, you know, the on purpose release things that are broken, so you have to buy new products in a year. You know, I don't know. But maybe you are in a position where you need to look for a new job, and that's possible. God doesn't say you can't look for a new job at all. But I do think that you should stay working. You know, some folks are like, screw it, I'm quitting. You know, they quit their job and they go to look for a new job. I don't think that's necessary, especially these days. I don't think that's the best thing for you to do. But, you know, it's not unbiblical to look for a new job. There's nothing wrong with looking for a new job. You know, maybe God's got a new job waiting for you. He wants to use you in a new place. But the reason I say you should keep working when you're looking, is back in Ephesians 4, we saw this. He talked about, he who steals must steal no longer, but rather he must labor. He must get a job. Why? And he performing with his own hands what is good, so that he will have something to share with one who has need. You know, we're supposed to be sharing with one another. And if you quit your job out of an impulse because you want to find a new one, you don't like it, you take this job and shove it type of attitude, you're not able to share with others. Instead, you're taking from others. And that's not what we're called to do. We're supposed to work. If we're able to work, we're supposed to be working. So, you know, I don't encourage you to quit your job and walk out and find a new one. But if you're at the point where you really feel like God, you know, this isn't where He wants you to be, then look for a new job. Go for it. But, you know, keep your other job. There's nothing wrong with working while you're looking for a new job. I've done that many times at Aetna. Every time, in fact, I've started looking for a new job at Aetna, God has said, nope, Aetna's where you need to be. And He's made it a point to me that I should stay there. So there's nothing wrong with continuing to work where you are while you look. So why is this so important? You know, I want to wrap up with this verse here. Remember Ephesians 2. Early on in our series, we talked about this. It says, for we are His workmanship. And that word workmanship really means masterpiece. We're God's masterpiece. And we're created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand so that we could walk in them. We're God's masterpiece. Now, an artist creates a masterpiece. He doesn't shove it under a tarp and throw it in the attic or hide it under his bed, right? He puts it on display. We are on display here. This is God's work He's done in us. When we're at our jobs and when we're parents, we are God's workmanship. We are on display to our kids. We're on display to the world. We're our co-workers. They see us. And they know that we're Christians. And I don't mean to say that as Christians we shouldn't have any problems, that we're a shining example in the world. I hope that's clear. Most of you who know me know that's not the case, right? I'm far from an example of a great parent, far from an example of an exemplary employee. And yet, you know, here I am. God says I'm His workmanship. I'm His masterpiece. I'm on display. People are looking. So we should approach our parenting. We should approach our work as if we're doing it for God, because people are looking, and we're an example of Christianity to people, to the world who's not Christians. We're that light to the people. So this is important stuff. This is how you can be a Christian all the time, not just on the weekends and at night. You know, this is how we're supposed to be a Christian all the time. Okay. So we're going to quit there. Next week, we're going to look at Ephesians 10 through 6, 10 through 17. If you're a first time here, you've never been here before, we've got a free book for you. One of two, actually, out there at the Welcome Center. Both of them are good reads. Welcome cards. If you have one of these weekly updates, there's welcome cards in there. It's a little deceiving, that name, because, you know, if you're new, we'd like to get to know you better, and that's why they call them welcome cards. But this is for anybody. If you have ideas on how we can make things better in our church, things that you think we should change, things that you think we should do more of, put that stuff in there and drop it in the bag as it comes by, because, you know, we read these. And we, you know, if you have a question also, if you have a question that you don't feel comfortable asking in front of everybody, write it down. We'll get back to you. All right, so that's what the welcome card's for. Guests, you're our guests. We don't want your money. We're going to have an opportunity to financially support the church here. You know, this is just for people who think of this as their church home. This is not, we don't want your money if you're a guest here. Feel free to just pass that bag on by. Or if you got to put something in it, put in your welcome card. So we've got a while here. We've got several minutes here before we have to pick up the kids. They're safe until 11:45. That's when we set them loose. So we got time here for questions and for comments. So if you have questions and comments already, we got one. Just raise your hand. We'll bring you a mic. And we'll talk.
Well, first I want to say great teaching. Thank you so much. I was thinking, well, thematically, as we're talking about employers, parents, that kind of stuff, being employees, and one motif I thought of across all amongst of those is clearly spelling out your expectations. And I can't tell you a number of times either I have or someone I've worked with thinks they're extremely clear about what they want or how to make it happen, and ironically, of course, they're not. Mm-hmm. And so as parents, that's something to check on, is to say, okay, this is my expectation, and then, yes, sit there and watch. And so that's something as a parent or as an employer or as a friend to make sure that what you said actually connects, right?
Right.
So that's an important thing. And the other thing I'd learned the hard way in the business world was, if you don't train someone to succeed, you're training them to fail. And once again, friends, children, parents, work, it's a very consistent theme. And I think a lot of frustration we have is precisely because either we're not clear or we're not instructing well enough.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. You know, I had an issue, it wasn't last week, I think it was the week before, where my son was just being mean to his sister. You know, he wasn't loving her at all. And it's something that's been an ongoing, recurring theme in our household. And so I took him aside and I said, all right, look, you know, we've been talking about this verse in Philippians about how we're supposed to put others' needs in front of ours, think of others as more important than ourselves, because that's the attitude Christ had, right? And so I made him memorize it. And it's not a pattern I want to fall into regularly. I don't want to use Bible memorization as punishment. But it's something I was driving home to the kid, that he's not loving his sister. And I also asked him to look over 1 Corinthians 13, which talks about what love is. And so we had a conversation about, you know, this is what I'm doing. I'm setting up. This is what we expect here. This is what we're all looking for. I know none of us are going to hit it perfectly, but there are things that we can do that, you know, not screaming at your sister every chance you get, not pushing her down when she gets in your way. You know, these are the kinds of things that we can work on. You know, setting those examples, setting those expectations up front, you know. Sometimes we think people know things they don't know. And you're right, being clear is really important. Yeah. Other questions or comments?
Adam, thanks for this teaching. Verse 5, where it says, slaves, obey your earthly masters.
Mm-hmm.
I was working for a place a few years ago, and that was pointed out to me by management.
Okay.
That's
a good motivational poster to put on the wall.
I followed that mm-hmm. all the time. And I probably read it a couple times. But until today, one thing I never saw in there was where it says, just as you would obey Christ.
Mm-hmm.
When I was following my boss, my superior, my manager, not everything was kosher. Not everything was on the up and up. Not mm-hmm. everything was moral.
Right.
And I think that a lot of us as Christians, or people as Christians, we look at that, obey your earthly master. You know, how do you get past that when you're in a situation that, in a job you feel like you've been blessed with, but mm-hmm. you're forced to follow in a moral working environment.
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. You know, there's always that caveat, as you would follow Christ. Christ wouldn't want you to do anything immoral. And all the passages that talk about how we should obey authority, we got to keep in mind that the ultimate authority is God. And he's not going to want us to violate his will. He's not going to want us to sin. Just to make a quick buck, or so that our boss can make a quick buck. You know, I've had that opportunity at work. So we had a customer coming in, and I was putting together a presentation for my boss to give. And she said, here, put this presentation together. Here are the numbers I want you to use. You know, these aren't accurate yet, but we're working toward them. And I was like, you know, okay, well, if we do these things, these numbers will be accurate, but we're not doing them yet. And I wrestled with that, and I finally went back to her, and I said, I can't put these in here. I can't, in with a good conscience, put this stuff in here, because it's not true. And she's like, well, you know, we're working on it. I said, well, we're working on it, and that's what we should tell them, you know. And I don't know what she said in her, but she was like, you know what, you're right. I'm not going to make you put that in there, you know. I don't know what she said in the meeting, but you know, I think she appreciated the fact that we should question these things. And you know, if you get fired, if you don't climb the ladder because of it, then. That's probably okay. That's probably for the best. Because do you really want to climb a ladder in a company that has that kind of an ethos going on? Do you really want to be the management that now has to make those decisions? Because believe me, if you're a frontline employee and you're getting a little bit of pressure to make those decisions, the pressure to make those decisions at the next level of management and the next level above that is even greater. And, you know, maybe that's not the company where you should be trying to climb, you know. Thanks for pointing that out, though. Way up front.
Well, I guess I'm not the only one who watches The Exterminator. What is it, Billy the Exterminator or something like that?
Yeah, he came from that job. Yeah, that dirty job. He started there. Yeah.
Anyhow, what I wanted to say is simply this. As parents, we have such power in influencing our children.
Mm-hmm.
About which way they're going to go, And I think it would be a really good idea for all of us. I'm older, my kids are older, of course, they're out of the house, but just to study our kids and ponder them and think about what are their gifts, what do they need to hear? Mm-hmm. Because I know you can tell somebody, you can tell a young kid, that was really a good decision you made there, you know? You got a good mind. And repeat that occasionally, as long as it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And that will have a big effect on that kid.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you can say, you know, that really wasn't that cool. I'm not sure you're that sharp or whatever. Mm-hmm. I actually heard of a man who told his young daughter, you know, you need to find some uglier girlfriends to play with. Honest to God. I mean, I know the woman.
That's awful.
Believe me, it had a big effect on her.
Oh, man.
But what I'm saying is this. We have such power in our tongue, mm-hmm. particularly as parents with our kids.
Yeah.
You know, I think we really need to pray about it and think about how can I help mold this person into the person God wants them to be.
Yeah. That's a great point. And one of the things I regularly pray about, especially when I'm struggling with how to raise my kids, is, you know, I realize that God loves them more than I do. And that he knows better than I do how to raise them. And I pray that he uses me as a tool to raise those kids. That he's the one raising them. Yes, he's using me and he's using Don, but he's using us as opposed to us doing it on our own because we're so inadequate. And you're right. You know, a word of encouragement at the right time is way more powerful than a word of punishment when they're doing something wrong. And he comes out in their grade. You know, with one of our kids, we were working on the grades, and, you know, when there's no good grades, it's hard to say, well, you know, nice job. But we're coming down on him a little bit with the grades, and then when he starts improving, that's when the rubber meets the road. That's when you really encourage, see, I knew you could do it. You know, I knew you could do that. I knew you were smart. I knew you can do better even. I know that you can do this stuff. It's that kind of stuff, that encouragement is... really goes a lot much longer way than the negative stuff. Yeah. Any other comments? Dan.
It's a very aptly timed teaching for me because I'm right in the middle of our preparation for our DC trip, which is always, always bare, and it's mm-hmm. very difficult work to do. And just the attitude swings that I found myself going through, you know, from, you know, up yours to why are we doing this to, you know, it's run the gambit. And so mm-hmm. just hearing this teaching has really helped set my thoughts straight on some of this stuff. It's, fortunately, it's my last DC trip because they gave me a promotion, so it won't be so much my life.
All right. But, delegate.
Yes. But nonetheless, you know, I'm sure that there's still going to be some of the same issues coming up, no mm-hmm. matter who my manager is, no matter what position I'm working in, because I'm a fallen creature. Mm-hmm. I'm a screwed up person just like anybody else in that workplace. And, you know, but it's just refreshing to hear some teaching on this, particularly right now, for my attitude, just to, number one, be thankful for the different position that I have. Number two, just... when I walk through those doors, it is Christ that I'm working for,
mm-hmm.
and not necessarily my employers. If you serve at your workplace like you're serving Christ with a genuine heart, your bosses will take care of themselves.
Yep, that's a great point. All right, well, let's take a few minutes to pray together. Maybe we can pray for our bosses, because sometimes I find that's the best thing to do. It's hard to be angry at somebody you're praying for regularly, right? So maybe we should pray for that. Let's take some time to pray together. Raise your hand if you'd like to out loud, and we'll bring you a mic.
Thank you for working in my life, Lord. I, you know, just growing up, not having a whole lot of hope for the future, Lord, and I think you've put me in a great place, God, and I thank you for that. I do thank you for my parents. They weren't perfect, but they did all right, Lord. And just pray for work, too, God. Just ask that you would help me be a tool in your hand in the lives of the people there and have a positive impact and not be the one who's griping all the time, God. So just thank you for the changes in my life in that area. Still struggle with them. The struggles are still there. But I think you changed me quite a bit.
Now, God, I thank you for my job, too. You know, it's something that I've not always been grateful for. But you've done some pretty major things in my life through that job, and I appreciate that. You know, and I also thank you for my parents. I hope that you teach me and everyone else how we can honor our parents, show us how best to, you know, not for me, it's not dismissing what they say as old-fashioned or not dismissing what they say because they're uninformed or whatever, but really listen to what they have to say and really contemplate how I can honor the weight of their position as my parents. And also, God, I pray that you help me to be a good parent to my kids so that it makes it easier for them to follow that command as well, to honor their parents. Amen.